This is John Williams. Thanks for joining us weekdays between noon and one. We start with the weekly jobs report sponsored by Breezy.hr. That's Breezy HR. And Paul Nolte joins us, the portfolio manager at Kingsview Investment Management. Hi again, Paul. I hope you're well.
Doing very well. Thank you, John.
So just talk a little bit about where those numbers are. I think it's kind of funny because you said in your notes that every now and then you think you've got the economy figured out and it throws you a curveball. What's the curveball you're talking about?
The curveball is, you know, right now the jobs that we're getting added or re-added, I guess would be a better terminology, have been in the hospitality area, and they tend to be a little lower wage jobs. So you say, well, gosh, we're creating all these jobs, but wages went down. Why is that? And it's where we're adding those types of jobs. The other part of it is that the real big curve is we're making the comparison to a year ago. Well, a year ago, we were pretty well shut down and everybody's staying at home and say, well, gosh, look at, you know, how much we've grown, or look at this number. It's 110% better than it was a year ago. So the comparisons get to be really tough because we've never seen numbers like that. So you have to go back really over 2 years or maybe three and say, okay, how do those numbers compare to 2 years ago or 3 years ago, and where are we at in that process? And we still have a long way to go to get back to what passes for normal.
Yeah, it's almost impossible then to find an apples to apples, because 2 years ago and 3 years ago, we weren't recovering from a pandemic. It's almost impossible to find a normal even for 2021, isn't it?
It is, but, you know, and that's why I said, when let's look at the jobs report as an example. You know, we created or returned 850,000 jobs. It's a huge number. A really good month is 200, maybe 300. So it is an order of magnitude 2-3 times what we would normally see in a really good economy. And that being said, we still, if we were to create another 800,000 jobs each month for the next 8 months, it's going to take us that long just to get back to where we were in December of 19. So that's what I mean. We still have a long way to go just to get back to where we were in 19, even though we see these huge numbers that, you know, should get everybody all excited that things are returning back to normal. And that's what I mean. We're a long way from that normal range.
What do you say about the, I'll say, stubbornness of some people to go back?
And that's out of my realm of expertise. But, you know, there's a lot of different factors that are involved. One is, am I going to return back to my job that I had? In some cases, they're like, you know, I don't want that job anymore. I'm going to try to get a different position. Some are saying, you know, hey, I can stay at home. I'm getting a nice paycheck from the government. And maybe that allows, instead of having both husband and wife going back, maybe just one goes back and the other one stays at home because of childcare issues. So there's a lot of factors that are at play as to how we're going to get back to that normal level. And some of it is payments from the government allowing us to stay where we're at and not necessarily look for a job. Others are personal situations where they say, you know, we don't have child care. We don't have a way to take care of things.
Yeah, I'm anxious to see what happens. Maybe jobs reports in October might be telling.
Yeah, I think the last 3 months of the year, I think, are going to be very interesting, as long as they don't extend those programs. But we could get into that circular argument that, why, look, we still have a lot of people unemployed. We need to extend those benefits to those that are unemployed still. So you get into that.
One last thing. What's your read on the markets, S&P and the Dow?
You know, right now, they're benefiting from the Fed, and the Fed is going to stay on the sidelines and continue to inject money into the markets and the economy. But from a very long-term perspective, and I mean the next two to five years, the market is extraordinarily expensive. We're getting into ranges like we've seen in 1999, 2007. In the next 12 months to 2 years wasn't great at those moments. So today, you know, we look okay. We're very close to all-time highs. But I think going forward, it's going to be very tough to justify markets at current valuations with an economy that's still in the repair mode and may take much longer than many think to get back to prior levels.
Paul Nolte, portfolio manager, Kingsview Investment Management, kingsview.com. Thanks, Paul.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
I hope so. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch, and Ian Schur is an editor-at-large at CNET. Their site, of course, is cnet.com. Hi, Ian. Thanks for joining us.
How you doing?
Pretty good. I can't believe this headline. I'll just read it. It's from your site. It says here, LG's rollable OLED, OLED or OLED TV is coming to the United States for a whopping $100,000. What the Sam hell is this, Ian?
You're talking about the $100,000 in pocket change, right?
Yeah.
It's really fascinating. What they are doing is that for several years now, LG has been showing off a television that is really remarkable. What it does is it actually folds and rolls into itself. So we have a video on CNET so that you understand what it looks like. But essentially, you push a little button, and it kind of retracts into this box, and it goes away. And LG thinks this is the future, that this is the way that televisions eventually will be, is that they won't be these black boxes when we're not using them on our walls. They're going to hide into our furniture. Now, the first version of anything is always expensive, and $100,000 is a lot to ask. I mean, that's 50 times a good television. But the wow factor aside, there's a lot of really nifty technology in here that in the future is very likely to be the way that a lot of our televisions work.
Wow. That's an interesting point, though, because I've seen a lot of nice living rooms and nice houses, and a feature above the fireplace is the TV set, and that kind of makes me sad. If you could sort of have your cake and eat it, that's what it sounds like. I don't like it for $100,000, but I like the concept.
Well, and also, it's worth noting, the television makers have been trying increasingly over the years. You know, they got the screens really thin. That's great. I'm really happy about that. And they also have come up with other ways to make the screens less obtrusive. You know, some of them have worked on creating screens that have screensavers that look like wallpaper, right? Like, literally look like it could just be a part of your wall. Or they have other thing that turn it into art or something like that. Yeah. But the reality is that coming up with a way for it to just disappear is genius. And now that the technology has gotten to a point where they can do it, admittedly not for cheap, is really promising. It really gives me a sense of what the future will feel like.
You're noticing that the first iteration of anything is always the most expensive. Reminds me of our morning show. Bob Surratt today reminded us the obituary of the guy from Chicago who had the patent for the first Ampex recording machine for audio tape, so Elvis and them could record. Or no, it wasn't audio tape. I think it was an Ampex digital. I think this is how they were able to record old TV shows originally instead of putting them on film. Point was, the thing was the size of an oven, and it cost like $50,000. And then fast forward a few decades, and you and I had a VCR that we don't even want now. You know, it's funny how quickly the technology adapts, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I mean, $1965, $50,000 with inflation is worth $431,000 today, according to Google. So, very expensive recorder.
I also wanted to ask you about social networks struggling to shut down racist abuse after England's Euro Cup final loss. I don't know what I just said, except that on Twitter I was seeing, and even on the joke pages I go to, a lot of mean-spirited chatter about whatever happened in Europe. What are we talking about here?
That sport they play in that other country. You know, look, I think what's interesting here is that, you know, the Euro Cup, I mean, first off, obviously, you know, Europe and a lot of the world is very into soccer, right? And we may not be as much here in the States, but we can understand a major loss is always disappointing for anybody. But what's unfortunate is that some of the people who were very much involved in the loss, right, the big mistakes that happened during the game, were made by people who have names that are not typically British and who have skin colors that are not white. And even though they are British citizens, they were attacked viciously by people online. And we're talking about 19-year-old kids here, right, who are in this game and playing for England. But it was terrible what was said. And we have some stuff on CNET to show you just kind of how bad some of it got. But the worst part, I think, and what matters more, because there's always going to be jerks out there, is that the social networks did such a poor job dealing with it. A number of people went online and actually showed where they had reported very, undebatably, unambiguously offensive stuff. to Twitter or Facebook or YouTube. And they just and they came back and they said, no, it's okay. We're going to leave it up.
Oh, really?
And that is the sad part, right? That this stuff perpetuates in part because these networks don't do anything.
Not that this matters, but were those Brits dumping on the British players?
It was everybody. I mean, that's the sad part. It came from all over the place. I mean, also, this is social networks, right, with anonymous usernames. Sometimes you can't tell. But the expectation, and by the way, the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who is known to be a rather, you know, flamboyant person, he was very clear in believing that he believed that a lot of British people were doing this. So, and he spoke out against it, which is, I think, very notable. So it's clearly a problem. That is, you know, it's always been a problem, but it's clearly a problem that now has gotten to a point where it is noticeable after this type of event.
What is CNET saying about all the billionaires going to space?
I'm jealous is what I'm saying. You know, it's interesting. Jeff Bezos is supposed to take off in 5 days on his rocket. He'll be going with his brother and two other people into space. And, you know, we've had Richard Branson, Elon Musk is supposed to be next. I mean, look, it's kind of, at one point, it feels frustrating because you're watching a bunch of billionaires go into space instead of, you know, scientists and all the people we're used to. It's definitely a new age of space. And also, you know, they're trying to create space tourism. The question I have, really, is what this all means for the future of how we get around, right? It's really nifty they take these five-minute flights up to space, but you know, there's a lot of promise for if they can make this stuff cheap enough, actually being able to get us across the world in much shorter times. You know, that is what I'm really excited about, taking off from Chicago and landing in South Africa inside of a couple hours. That would be amazing.
How is it that that happens? Is it the speed they gain? Do they go super fast when they're up super high?
Yeah, so the higher you get, the easier it is to move, right, essentially. And what I think is what's interesting is that there have, you know, NASA has worked on a lot of different ideas around this. One of my favorites that they came up with was an airplane that would actually skip across our atmosphere. So it would go up, and then it would kind of skip on the atmosphere, go up, skip on the atmosphere. So you'd get probably very sick in the process. But it would get you from one part of the world to another in a very short amount of time. Obviously, none of us want to go through that. But the idea that you can get into either orbital flight or suborbital flight, right, get up high enough that you're able to move through the atmosphere at a much faster pace and get where you want to go much quicker is really appealing. And I love the idea that this could be eventually getting there. It's a little weird that it's billionaires who are doing this first, but hey, mm-hmm. They're funding it, so I can't really criticize them too much.
Well, is that the only way they make a profit, is to commercialize it, to have passengers who want to travel great distances? I mean, otherwise, how do they make money on this?
Well, that's the unfortunate reality of it, right? I mean, look, the reason that the space race worked out for us back, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, wasn't because we made money off it. It was because it was good politics at the time. And the reality was that making a business out of it is really hard, which is why as NASA started to actually have to deal with their finances and they couldn't just rely on the Cold War to help fund everything, they ended up getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So private enterprise finding ways to actually be able to do this profitably means that space travel can actually happen. You know, there have been for decades before that, we would have a succession of presidents get at a podium and say, we want to go back to the moon, and then nothing would happen because they couldn't get the money together to do it. The idea that we can do this on, you know, as essentially private enterprise and be able to make it work, that's great.
Ian Schur, one of the editors at large at CNET, CNET.com. Always fun, Ian. Thanks for your help today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN with Pete Zimmerman, the producer. This is John Williams. We're talking now about a company called CoinFlip from Chicago. It owns and manages ATMs that deal in a half dozen digital currencies. ATMs that deal in digital currencies. Think about that for a minute. Almost all of it is Bitcoin business, but still, what a concept. It has recently expanded to New Mexico and Alaska. They've got 2,500 terminals now in almost all of the 50 states. It's run by a couple of guys who for 4 years now have been able to drink legally. They're that young. Imagine that. So here's Ben Weiss, the CEO of CoinFlip at CoinFlip.com. Hey, Ben, thanks for joining us on WGN.
Thanks so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
You and your business partner started this company from your dorms, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. We saw the potential in promise in Bitcoin, and we had some tech background, and we saw, you know, even with the tech background, how hard it was to buy Bitcoin and to buy digital currency. But we knew it was going to fundamentally change the financial system, and we wanted to make sure that everyone had the opportunity and chance to buy it, and we saw how difficult it was. And that's why we started CoinFlip, and we've been plugging and chugging ever since.
So what does CoinFlip do? How do these ATMs work?
So the ATMs are located typically gas stations, convenience stores, restaurants, you name it. All you need with you to go to the ATM is cash, your phone, depending on the amount, your driver's license. You go to the machine, you scan your Bitcoin wallet. If you don't have a wallet, we have 24/7 customer support that'll help you make sure you get a wallet and get your Bitcoin safely and securely. But you scan your wallet at the machine, you put in your cash, and you get your Bitcoin in under 10 minutes. CoinFlip's the only place you can get your Bitcoin in under 10 minutes. And with 24/7 customer support, you don't have to worry about your Bitcoin going to the wrong place or, you know, not getting your transaction fulfilled. So we pride ourselves on making sure that everyone gets their Bitcoin safely, securely, and quickly.
Yeah, you get your Bitcoin, meaning simply you credit your account. You don't get a token or anything for that. Do you even get a paper?
Correct.
Do you get a paper receipt?
You get a digital receipt automatically sent to you either via email or text. And correct, Bitcoin is digital. So, you know, you would scan your Bitcoin wallet. There's no physical Bitcoin, but it would show up on your wallet. And one thing to understand about Bitcoin too, you know, while you can have a third party hold your coin, such as Coinbase and things like that, the difference with Bitcoin is you are your own bank. You hold your own funds. So you'll have a wallet on your phone, such as the BRD wallet. You scan that, the Bitcoin gets sent to you. It's important that you remember all your passwords and things like that, because it's not like you can't call, you know, Chase Bank and they'll reset your password for you. So sort of the difference with Bitcoin versus the traditional banking system is you are your own bank.
Yeah, we have told on a few occasions and even talked to the guy here on this show whose Bitcoin bank is valued at several hundred million dollars. He can't remember his password. And you get 10 tries, you get 10 tries, and then it locks you out permanently. He's done it wrong 8 times. He's sitting on a value that he may never capture.
He only has 2 more tries, right?
Yeah. So does the reverse work? If I go to one of these Bitcoin kiosks, these ATMs, can I get cash from them for my Bitcoin?
Correct. So at most locations, you can cash out as well, not at every single location. But there are locations in the city you can cash out. And if you want to cash out, you should be able to see online which are the ones you can cash out, but call customer support and make sure the one you're going to is one you can cash out as well. Mm-hmm. But 90%+ of our business has been people buying Bitcoin. Most people don't want to sell it, but if you do want to sell it, you know, you can use it. You can go to one of our ATMs and get cash for your Bitcoin.
Do you worry that the need to use the ATMs is going to fade as people get more comfortable doing it on their laptops and other devices?
No, I mean, that would be a good thing if the ATMs fade. Like, the point is to get everyone as much Bitcoin as possible. You know, when everyone has Bitcoin, we won't even need the ATMs. When everyone has it on their phones and things like that, we won't even need the ATMs. If we don't need the ATMs anymore, then I feel like I've done my job, because the whole point was to get is people Bitcoin.
Maybe, but I mean, you're not Bitcoin, you're CoinFlip. You are the vendor or the transactor. So how does your business exist or pivot if that happens?
So we have an OTC desk where people can send wire transfers for Bitcoin. We take credit and debit cards online as well. But, you know, there's still Western Unions, there's still MoneyGrams. There will always be underbanked people using the machines to send money back home. But But now we've seen, you know, the majority of customers are people who like the 24/7 customer support. They like the physical aspect of it. It's not intimidating. It's easy. It's simple. It's safe. But, you know, in 10 years, if there's no ATMs, because, you know, everyone's in the Bitcoin ecosystem or the digital ecosystem, I think, you know, we've done our job. But as an entrepreneur, you always have to be innovating. I mean, Amazon starts, you know, started off selling books, for God's sake. So, you know, a good company innovates and pivots.
$51 million in revenue last year. Do you take a percent then of each transaction?
Yeah, so CoinFlip charges transaction fees just like any other ATM. And, you know, the average person's putting in a couple hundred dollars. So that's the great thing about the ATMs. You have extra cash laying around. You just got paid. You want to put in a little bit. You put it in. You get your coin right away. You know, there's a transaction fee. But again, you know, we want to give people as many options to buy Bitcoin as possible. We also take wires online. We also take credit cards. So, you know, however you want to get your Bitcoin, we are there for you.
ATM is an interesting concept. Most of us deal with that as a way to get the cash we have. We don't think of it, though, as an investment vehicle. And I think that's the way most people have been reporting on Bitcoin, is not a currency, but as an investment. That is, hey, it went down 8% today. I'll go ahead and throw a couple hundred in there and bet that I've bought it on the low. Is that how people are using it? They're driving along or they're thinking, you know,
correct.
Bitcoin is
so
off. I've got 200 bucks.
At least in the U.S., I would think of Bitcoin more as a digital gold than I would think of it as a cryptocurrency. It's not a currency, at least not in the U.S. Now, if you want to look at other countries, especially more third world countries where there's inflation, where there's unstable governments, things like that, then you are seeing it used as a currency. But in the U.S., it's more of an asset. And if we want to talk about some of those other places, like one of the cool things about Bitcoin that, you know, I think people don't fully appreciate yet is in the past, if you were fleeing an authoritarian regime or a country where there's instability, you would put everything you could on your back and you would flee. You know, what you could fit, you bring. With Bitcoin, you can now have a couple million dollars with just a password in your head. So I think, you know, I'm really, like, I love Bitcoin in the U.S., but I'm really excited about what it's going to do overseas. But in the U.S., it's an investment. Typically, not always. I don't think you're going to see people buying $4 cups of coffee anytime soon. For bigger ticket items, you know, potentially for international trade, yes, but I don't think you're going to see people buying Starbucks with Bitcoin anytime soon.
Yeah, although, you know, once upon a time, it was frowned upon if you went to McDonald's or Starbucks and used your credit card. This may predate you, my friend, but that was seen as undisciplined or excessive. You would have cash, you would have coins. That's how you made small purchases, and a credit card for a candy bar seemed dumb. And now it's almost weird if you're carrying around a lot of cash. So who knows? Maybe even though a Bitcoin might be valued at $60,000, you're not going to use all of it when you buy the gas at the pump. Maybe we will be using it as a currency.
Yeah, and I think another thing that, you know, people need to understand as well, because not everyone get, like, you know, a Bitcoin right now is 30 or whatever, however many thousand dollars it is, but it is infinitely divisible. You can buy $5 of Bitcoin, you can buy $500 of Bitcoin, you can buy $500,000 of Bitcoin. You don't have to transact in full Bitcoins.
Ben Weiss is the CEO of CoinFlip, coinflip.tech. If I said com, pardon me, coinflip.tech is the site. Hey, Ben, good luck to you guys. Fascinating, and let's stay in touch.
Yeah, thanks so much. And, you know, we love working in Chicago, and we love getting people Bitcoin, and thanks for having me on.
It's 1246. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's more business news. Here is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Contrasting information about the health of downtown Chicago. The Loop Alliance says its latest measurement shows downtown activity steadily rising. Its measurement in June shows the highest level of activity since the pandemic began. The Alliance says Loop office buildings are reopening amenity floors and loosening mask and distancing guidelines. The number of employees returning to work matches Los Angeles and Washington. Washington, D.C., and outperforms the New York and San Francisco Bay Area. On the flip side, the latest data shows downtown office vacancy is at its highest level on record. For the third straight quarter, downtown office vacancy rose to 19.4% in the Central Business District. Cranes reports several companies have recently moved to other buildings, and others have shed space altogether because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Real estate services firm CBRE says the office vacancy rate is the highest it's tracked in 15 years. The previous high was 18.6% at the end of the first quarter of this year. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
We got your business of food and Steve Alexander.
Yeah, you know, we've heard from many of our farm friends that are in the business of producing meat that the pandemic provided them with a new market for their livestock. People who are discovering the magic of buying meat direct from the farm.
It's certainly an exciting time for small producers and meat processors.
That is Dr. John O'Keefe.
I am the Bureau Chief of Meat and Poultry Inspection for the Illinois Department of Agriculture.
And what's been happening is the farmer who raises, well, let's say beef, is contacted by a neighbor or a friend or a relative or a friend of a neighbor or relative or friend who likes the idea of buying direct from the farmer with a small meat processor doing the cutting and wrapping.
They're probably going to get a better quality of beef if they're buying it from their neighbor, somebody they know, and getting it cut exactly the way they want it.
Yeah, a lot of people agree, and that's why demand has overwhelmed supply, and small processing plants all over Illinois are backed up.
Most of our small state establishments are scheduled through the end of the year. Probably preaching to the choir, the people that are out there, the farm people, know that if they're looking to get an animal slaughtered, it is hard to find any place with capacity to do it this year.
More supplies on the way, though, because 8 new plants have been started in the past year.
That's probably double to maybe triple what we usually would get. Some years we've gone where none have opened.
O'Keefe says it generally takes a year for plants to be built from the ground up, with state inspectors following every step. But there are also about 30 current plants that are expanding. Yes, it's a gamble.
One of the questions will be, once they get this backlog done, you get a year or two down the line, I wonder what would the demand will be for the small producers.
Dr. John O'Keefe believes the demand is still going to be there. At the Chicago Board of Trade right now, we've got a mixed bag with corn trading, well, it's up about a quarter of a penny now. Beans are down 3.5 cents, and wheat is trading 17 cents higher. At the Merck, we've got hogs and feeder cattle up about 40 cents, and live cattle are down a quarter. Lots to celebrate today. National Gummy Worm Day. Remember the cattle story yesterday? That's a byproduct of cows. National Tapioca Pudding Day. And it is National I Love Horses Day. I don't think they mean I love horses to eat, just appreciate horses. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Let's close today with a little consumer news. Amy Guth's got at least some helpful information about sunscreens. Hi, Amy.
Hi there. Yeah, indeed, I do have some information about that. So Johnson & Johnson has said that they are recalling 5 of its sunscreen products. Some of the samples in some independent lab testing were found to contain low levels of benzene, which is a chemical that can cause cancer with repeated prolonged exposure. So these are Aveeno and Neutrogena products. It's the Aveeno Protect and Refresh aerosol sunscreen, and then there's 4 different Neutrogena types. So if you have purchased this, Johnson & Johnson is offering a refund. You can call their consumer care center. It's 1-800-458-1673. But you can also just go to the Neutrogena or Aveeno websites, and there's information on both the websites about those recalls.
I understand that you are following the Netflix business and that they are getting into video games.
That's right. I think this is very interesting. I'm very closely following all things streaming because I think it's such an interesting space right now. And Netflix has said exactly that. They're going to get into the video game hustle. And that seems perhaps like maybe it's an odd match. And why are they doing that exactly? But if you think about it, it actually makes perfect sense because their competitors like Disney and Comcast, NBC, Universal, they've got other ways to make money, especially Disney. You know, they've got products, they've got licensing, they've got all this other stuff. You know, all these other streaming services, they have other products, not so much Netflix. They're so reliant on that subscription revenue. So the best they can do is think of what are other ways to drive subscriptions. So they're adding this. They've said it will be sometime this year. Now we'll see how that goes. Google, they had launched a video game platform and then shuttered it back in about February or March. And they said they're not going to do that. That was Stadia, their platform. Amazon had a gaming strategy that really didn't feel like it was very successful. And they had the Luna streaming video game platform. So we'll see how that goes. But they've said that they're getting into this. They've made a really interesting hire. They hired Mike Verdue. He used to be with Facebook Reality Labs. And he was also the vice president of mobile for EA, which is one of the biggest names in gaming. So we'll see what happens with Netflix moving into the gaming space.
Hey, and GM's got a problem with some of those Chevy Bolts. I saw one the other day. It's a beautiful, cute little car.
Yeah, it is a cute car. I've driven one, and I think it's a cool little car. But they issued a recall a while back because there were some cars that were catching on fire. So they issued this recall. So there's a small fix they need to do. It's not even a part. It was just like a computer kind of reconfiguration. Had everybody head to the dealership, and they fixed it for them. But there are now the automaker is saying that they're asking people to not park the vehicle inside overnight or while charging, because even after the recall repairs, two have recently caught on fire. So the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said it's the cell packs. They do have the potential to smoke and ignite internally. So they have been investigating the bolts since October. But, you know, that recall was over about 70,000 bolts. And that was about the 2017 to 2019 models. Even still, we've seen these two fires just recently. So they're asking people for right now, while they're working to sort this out, if you have one of those cute little cars, do not park it in your garage, because it very well could catch on fire.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks again, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.